Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, April 10, 2013. President Obama unveils a budget that will unchain my CPI.
Ouch!
Chain, chain, chain! Chain, chain, chain!
Thank you, Aretha. So we got a budget blueprint out of the White House today, long awaited, and not too many surprises, including the effort to cut Social Security payments in the future through the so-called chained CPI, Consumer Price Index. The 10-year plan calls for $300 billion in new spending on jobs, public works, preschool education, calls for $800 billion in new taxes, including an extra 94 cents a pack on cigarettes. But the president's plan also would cut more than $1 trillion from programs across the federal government, except for the goddamn Defense Department. Pardon my French, but it is so infuriating to see this dance go on in Washington. The phony Republican deficit hawks on one side, the people who created the deficit who are now so determined to wipe it out by cutting domestic and social spending. They, of course, don't bring up defense cuts. But neither does the White House. Neither do most Democrats. So we have a conversation that occurs very politely inside the lines. Nobody grabs that crayon and paints outside the lines. And it's all tacitly agreed that defense, intelligence, homeland security, as they call it, all of those simply cannot be cut. But taking money away from retirees, from those who get a disability benefit from Social Security, or a survivor benefit, that for some reason is seen as just a painful necessity required to deal with the overwhelming deficit. And so Obama starts off by conceding a very critical point to Democrats. Once again, as I call it, he's negotiating with himself because Republicans are not engaged. They're not at the table. They're laughing off this plan from the president. They say it doesn't go far enough to cut entitlements. And the president, in a statement, said, "When it comes to deficit reduction, I've already met Republicans more than halfway." Well, I don't know what the right metaphor is to use here. He has conceded before there has been a bargaining session. And all it will do, once the door is open to cutting Social Security benefits, is cause the Republicans to propose more cuts. And this started in the summer of 2011, when he caved on the debt ceiling issue and created the phony super committee that led to the phony fiscal cliff, that led to the phony sequester. And all of these, the president stands there and acts like a victim. And, of course, what we really need to do is restore the middle class, enhance consumer demand as a way of growing the economy. The economy grows, the deficit declines. It is really that simple. And yet, our leaders in Washington are just spinning themselves in deeper and deeper. I don't smoke, so I'm not really opposed to a big jump in the federal cigarette tax. In some states, that'll make a pack of smokes $7 or $8. And I think we have punished smokers enough, frankly. And while the president calls for closing corporate tax loopholes, there's no substance to it. Corporations used to pay about 30% of the total revenue flowing into the federal government every year. It is down below 10%. It's in single digits. And the offshore accounts and the way Apple Computer takes your iTunes money to Belgium and Ireland or wherever else they harbor it. Nobody's addressing those schemes and saying, if you want to be an American company, pay your damn taxes. And so this is a day that is dark in many ways, because it's very clear from this starting point that Obama will only cave in more. I took in a conference call earlier today with two of the really bright and fiery leaders of progressive Democrats in the House. Alan Grayson of Florida, he's been on our program twice already this year. Keith Ellison of Minnesota, the guy we praised for his smackdown of Sean Hannity at the end of February. And these men have the right intentions. They articulate very clearly, as you're about to hear, that these truly are cuts the president is proposing. And that, you know, they don't even claim to understand why the president is doing this. You'll hear Keith Ellison mention that briefly. But I think you'll find that these men are too subdued. Their tone is business as usual. Ellison says, well, don't personalize this and take on Obama. Just stand for Social Security and the integrity of that contract for people who've worked 30, 40, even 50 years expecting a retirement benefit that would not be cut at the end of that long road. And you'll hear Alan Grayson speaking positively, saying, wow, over 30 Democrats have signed on to the Grayson-Takano letter pledging to never vote to cut these benefits. 30? Only 30 out of 200 Democrats in the House? Out of, what, 70 members of the Progressive Caucus? And so, while I support the efforts of Grayson and Ellison to challenge the president of their own party on this very bad proposal, I'm frankly alarmed that they're not more alarmed and that they're not sounding the alarm and saying, go to your window and scream, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it. No, they talk about organizing, organizing, and organizing some more. And in the excerpt from this conference call that you're about to hear at the very end, Alan Grayson speaks up for Nancy Pelosi. And he correctly points out that she has a 30-year history of opposing cuts to Social Security. He didn't mention that her greatest achievement during her first 2 years as Speaker of the House was blocking George W. Bush's efforts to privatize Social Security. And Grayson politely says that some of the statements Pelosi has made recently have been misinterpreted. I don't think so. When Pelosi spoke in December about the need to strengthen Social Security, and the frame of the question was about the chained CPI, I don't think she explicitly endorsed it, she was sending a signal that she is bowing to the White House demand that Democrats unilaterally cough up cuts in Social Security. And I don't have to tell you, but I feel I must repeat the obvious, that you'll hear it from Grayson and Ellison, Social Security is not a contributor to the deficit. And it leads me back to a Joe McCarthy-era statement, have you no shame? And I offer that broadly to Democratic leaders who are willing to trade future increases in my Social Security benefits for some sort of phony bipartisan compromise that is not even within view. All right, let's listen to the commentary from Alan Grayson of Florida and Keith Ellison, both Democrats, Ellison from Minnesota.
We are experiencing what has been called the best of times and the worst of times. It's the worst of times because the Democratic president has proposed benefit cuts to both Social Security and Medicare. In the case of Social Security, we're talking about the chained CPI. And any way you look at it, arithmetically, it means fewer benefits paid out to people over time, literally. There's no conceivable way that such a calculation could possibly increase benefits. It simply decreases benefits. With regard to Medicare, we're seeing the president proposing to extend means testing beyond what it already exists for Medicare premium payments, right down into what most people regard as the middle class, down to the $47,000 level, and to create two classes of Medicare, which is a very dangerous precedent. The president wants to distinguish between the benefits that will be received by new Medicare recipients and the benefits that are received by existing Medicare recipients, which has been a long-time Republican proposal. So it's the worst of times because a Democratic president is proposing to cut benefits without receiving anything in return from the other side in programs that we regard as the core of our party's accomplishments over the past century. It's the best of times because people are fighting back. The BCCC has been on this and organizing against this now for over a year. In fact, really as long as 2 years. In our case, we've circulated the Grayson-Takano letter. Congressman Ellison has signed it. And the Grayson-Takano letter commits over 30 of our fellow members of Congress to vote against any and every cut in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid benefits. I think we're making progress. The fact that over 2 million people have signed our petition at nocuts.com, no-cuts.com, the fact that we've gotten over 30 members of Congress to sign our letter shows that people are feeling very frustrated about this, and understandably so. We are, to some degree, threatened by the possibility that we'll be robbing people of their choice in next year's election and the election after that. Based upon the budget that the Republicans submitted, the Ryan budget, it was pretty clear up to this point that the Republicans were the party in favor of cutting Social Security, cutting Medicare, cutting Medicaid, and the Democrats were the party against it. Now, with the president's proposal, we at least face the threat that we'll be stigmatized as a party that kind of is for it and kind of is against it, kind of depending upon circumstances, kind of. And that's just not fair to the American people. The American people deserve a choice. And what we're doing, really, is taking that choice away from them if we become the party that stands for nothing. Medicare is not the reason why there's a deficit. Social Security is not the reason why there's a deficit. In fact, the Social Security Trust Fund at $1.9 trillion is the largest sovereign wealth fund in the entire world.
This attack on Social Security and Medicare is bigger than Social Security and Medicare. As big as they are, it's bigger than that. Why is that? Because what are they doing? They're going after the National Labor Relations Board. They're going after the Post Office. They're going after all this stuff that regular working Americans for generations have worked for and has worked for them. This is part of a wave of deconstructing the ladder of opportunity in America, and we will not stand for it. Now, you might ask, why is Obama being part of it? I don't know. I don't even care. What I care about is organized Americans from New York to California, from Minnesota to Florida, saying no. We insist on making sure that people who are with disabilities, our seniors and people on survivor benefits have a bottom floor of decency, which they will not go below in this richest country in the history of the world. And also, let me just say this. There's no question but that this is a cut. There's no doubt that this is a cut in people's benefits. The fact is that every chart, every graph you see shows that the expected benefit is one thing, and what this thing is something else, lower. So I just want to say, be prepared for the long fight. Don't personalize the fight. Focus on principle. Make sure that you understand this is a wave of trying to take down the ladder of opportunity in America. And don't ever forget that people who stick to it and stay with it are going to win.
Congressman Pelosi has a 30-year record of defending Social Security and Medicare against all cuts. I know that she's made some statements on this subject in the past year or so that might be misinterpreted, but I know that if you had a private conversation with her off the record, I'm sure that I know what her answer would be. I'm sure that she would say that she's against cuts in Social Security and Medicare of any kind.
That's Alan Grayson, and right before him you heard Keith Ellison, Democratic members of Congress, talking about the president's proposed chained CPI adjustment to Social Security increases in the future. And I want to thank Brian Mazzi, who's a regular listener to this podcast. He dropped me an email saying that I've heard you talk about Obama negotiating with himself. I think that his history of offering up Social Security, as well as weakening it through the institution of the payroll tax holiday, shows that he's not negotiating with himself. He's clearly doing his best, likely at the behest of his corporate paymasters, to actually destroy the program and finally achieve what George W. Bush could not do, the privatization of the trillions of dollars socked away for our retirements, all with the aid of left cover. He goes on, luckily there are a few, like yourself, referring to me, who do not accept his every move as just and holy. But I do think you're giving him far too much credit, or failing to understand that the pattern is likely deliberate, not poor bargaining. Well, I'll take your point here. And I'm angry enough today, Brian, that I don't mind you essentially saying that I've been too generous on that front. The American Sustainable Business Council shared some polling information with me that I'll pass along to you related to the efforts to reduce the deficit and raise more revenue for the government. In their poll, which, by the way, was tilted toward Republicans, 47% of the respondents identified as Republicans. The proportion should be closer to 22% in terms of their national party registration. At any rate, given that backdrop, 4 out of 5 small business owners surveyed oppose a territorial tax system which would permanently exempt offshore profits from U.S. taxation. 76% of the small business owners surveyed support closing overseas tax loopholes. I just referred to that. 64% support ending deferral, a provision of current tax code that allows corporations to indefinitely defer payment of U.S. taxes on profits made or shifted offshore. And across party lines, 62% support this idea. And by a margin of more than 2-1, small business owners prefer to close corporate tax loopholes rather than cut government programs. Is anybody listening in Washington? Well, Norman Solomon, who was a candidate for Congress here in my district in California last year, published a piece at commondreams.org today. Let me quote liberally from this liberal. Obama's move to cut Social Security is certainly outrageous, and it's encouraging that a wide range of progressive groups are steamed at Obama as never before. But this kind of outrage should have reached a boiling point a long time ago. The administration's undermining of civil liberties, scant attention on climate change, huge escalation of war in Afghanistan, expansion of drone warfare, austerity policies serving Wall Street and shafting Main Street, vast deference to corporate power, ... the list is long and chilling. For progressives, there's not a lot to be gained by venting against Obama without working to implement a plausible strategy for ousting corporate war Democrats from state power. So is the evasive record of many groups that are now denouncing Obama's plan to cut Social Security. Mostly their leaders griped in private and made nice with the Obama White House in public. And he goes on, from this spring onward, a wide range of progressive groups should be prepared to work together to effectively renounce Obama's leadership. As of today, after many weeks of lobbying and pleading and petitioning nationwide, 47 members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus have refused to sign the Grayson-Takano letter pledging to vote against any and every cut to Medicare, Medicaid, or Social Security benefits. And Solomon concludes, after all this time, refusal to sign the letter is a big tip-off that those 47 House members are keeping their options open. And one of them is the guy who defeated Norman Solomon, Jared Huffman. He's not a bad guy, but he is more moderate than Solomon. He's refused to sign the letter, but he did come out today saying he would vote against cuts to Social Security. Why he's not willing to pledge to do that in all cases, I don't understand, and the next time I see Jared Huffman, I will certainly ask him about that. Norman Solomon is a prominent contributor, along with more than 35 others, to a powerful new documentary. And we interviewed the filmmaker of Shadows of Liberty, this important new documentary, Jean-Philippe Tremblay. And the interview is available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. In this excerpt, Jean-Philippe describes the film and who some of the contributors are and what he tried to define for the viewer.
What we do in the film is we do try to tell you a history of the United States, the media history of the United States, so that people can know how is it that we've ended up with five major conglomerates that control most of the information in the United States. And with that information, what we get is we get a lot of propaganda, a lot of distortion, and a lot of lies. And that's just not good enough for the people of the United States and around the world. You also mentioned the contributors of this film. I have in the film about 38 contributors whom I think are the most groundbreaking journalists, activists, and just thinkers of today in terms of freedom and freedoms of information. We have people like Norman Solomon, Amy Goodman, Daniel Ellsberg, Danny Glover. We have Bob McChesney. We have David Simon, the creator of The Wire for HBO. Christina Borgeson. We have Julian Assange from WikiLeaks, the most groundbreaking internet news source that we've ever seen. We have people like Bob Baer, who is the head of information for the CIA in the Middle East. That they all come to the film and they all come and tell their stories. And these are all people who have experience in the mainstream media or working for the government, for the CIA, for the FBI. And they all come to the film and they tell us their stories, which basically comes down to there's a lot of corruption going on. And instead of letting journalists being able to investigate that corruption about power, about governments, well, they are... basically, journalists are not able to report that, and certainly not in the mainstream media, because if they do confront power, then they're taken out of the picture, they're brushed aside, their careers are destroyed, and basically there's no room to hold power accountable in the mainstream. And the mainstream is really what controls the discourse and the conversation and political perception and cultural perception in the United States. And what this film is here to do is to remind us about that.
I hope you'll listen to the full interview with Jean-Philippe Tremblay, available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. And can I nudge you to step up and subscribe? Over 10,000 people listen to this daily news and comment podcast, and a handful of you are subscribers. And if you're able, I'm not looking for your Social Security money or your kids' college fund money. But if you're working and have an income, maybe you got a nice tax refund that came in the mail yesterday, I'd appreciate it if you could subscribe and help support our work here. Subscriptions, $1 for 24 hours, $5 a month, $50 for the annual subscription, and I do appreciate your support. Also, I want to mention that there is an offer for those of you who listen and respond to the Jean-Philippe Tremblay interview of a free DVD of his new important film. Be sure to check that out. The Postal Service has announced that it will cancel its plans to cancel Saturday mail delivery because Congress said they can't. And this is just another stunning move by the Congress that created the fiscal phony emergency that occurs at the Postal Service by forcing them to pay in advance the pension and health benefits of future retirees. It is a scam of immense proportions. And for Congress to refuse to address that underlying issue, which creates the appearance of insolvency at the post office, which is what drove the plan to cut Saturday deliveries, is just mind-boggling. And now, to tie the hands of the Postal Service and say, you have to use these phony accounting methods and you can't cut Saturday delivery in order to try to reduce the losses that are showing on the books of the Postal Service. It is just bizarre. And frankly, I'd gotten used to the idea of having Saturday delivery cut. It's not that important to me. It might be to some people, and I have no problem if you want to get active on that issue. But the real problem here is the way Congress has saddled the Postal Service with this phony deficit. And then they basically want to lay off the postal worker union labor force as a way of closing a deficit that doesn't really exist. Anthony Weiner is resurfacing. He resigned in disgrace from Congress after he tweeted a picture of his crotch with his undies on to some unsuspecting female admirers. And I don't think Anthony Weiner should have quit over that. He should have just toughed it out. But there was a moment of outrage. It occurred right at a time when he was introducing some important legislation. And so he quit. And as you may know, this occurred at a time when his wife, Huma Abedin, was either pregnant or had just delivered their son, Jordan. And Huma was a top assistant to Hillary Clinton at the State Department. So now Anthony Weiner is starting to resurface. He gave an interview to the New York Times with his wife and the child present. And it seems that he's trying to rehabilitate himself so that he can run for mayor of New York City. And I have to say I have mixed feelings because I met Anthony Weiner, interviewed him several times. And on certain issues, when he's fired up, he's great. In protecting workers and the middle class and in many domestic economic issues, I have no problem, and I appreciate the leadership that Anthony Weiner has provided. And as a candidate for mayor of New York, his position on the politics of Israel, probably less important, might help him raise some money in New York. But that's always been my problem, is Weiner is an out-and-out Zionist, and while he has some progressive positions on domestic issues, foreign policy, well, he and I don't agree much on that. Here in San Francisco, I've occasionally updated you on the controversy over Henry Alvarez, who has been the director of the San Francisco Housing Authority. Last fall, he was the subject of three lawsuits from people who worked for him, clearly accusing him of official misconduct. Not only that, the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development, placed the San Francisco Housing Authority on its list of troubled agency, giving it a score of 54 out of 100 on some sort of an evaluation. And Alvarez, a buddy of Mayor Ed Lee, had incredible protection that lasted until yesterday, when a commission of the Housing Authority, populated by new members recently appointed by Mayor Lee, gave him his walking papers, kind of. Now, he had a contract that runs through June 12th, $210,000 a year, and the critical date was April 30th, which is when he would have been vested in a state pension plan worth $23,000 a year for the rest of his life. Now, what the commissioners did was basically relieve him of his duties, but they've agreed to pay out the remainder of the contract, despite the fact that the Housing Authority is technically broke. Now, it seems they did that to avoid a lawsuit, but it's not clear to me if they continue paying him through June 12th whether his pension vesting as of April 30th will qualify or not. So we'll find out in the wash about that. And I'm sure Mayor Edley is relieved that this episode is behind him, but the double standard that he demonstrated, particularly when you compare that to the way he tried to railroad Sheriff Mercurimi out of office, Well, I'm not going to forget that, Ed Lee, and perhaps others in the Bay Area will not either. We have a new member of Congress who displaced Pete Stark. Pete was a friend of mine, an out liberal, the only atheist in the House of Representatives. He bungled his reelection campaign last year very badly and was upset. He was defeated by a young guy named Eric Swalwell, who is a member of a city council in just one town in the district. And Swalwell is struggling to distinguish himself as a freshman in Washington. So he gave a news conference and attacked the TSA, you know, the airport goons, over their plan to relax regulations of what you can carry on a plane. And in particular, he went after the relaxation of the rule about small folding knives. And I have to say that I applaud the TSA for attempting to relax the regulations. It's about time. The security theater that we have at airports is such a waste of time and money. And so to try to make it more rational, I think, is a good thing. But to start with pocket knives seemed to be pretty poor politics and create a rich, ripe target for people like Eric Swalwell. So he hammered John Pistoli, who is the head of the TSA, stands for Transportation Security Administration, by the way. And there are other members of Congress, including Jared Huffman, who I referred to earlier, and other Democrats from the Bay Area, from Barbara Lee to Mike Honda, who have signed on a letter protesting this new policy. And I think they're wrong, because Pistole points out that since 2005, TSA has permitted small scissors, knitting needles, that more than 3 billion passengers have flown without a single reported disruption from these objects. And since we now have locked cockpits, which that was not the case before 9/11, the risk of a box cutter or small knife being the weapon used to commandeer an airliner is sharply reduced. So if we think rationally about it, this makes sense. But at the same time, it doesn't make sense to make us take our shoes off when the magnetometer or even the Chertoff body scanner will examine what's in our shoes or between our feet and our shoes if we walk through with them on. There was only one case, the Richard Reed shoe bomber attempt. And since then, every American has had to take their shoes off at the airport. It's bullshit. And likewise, the idea that 3 ounces of liquid is the sweet spot. You can carry on a little bottle with nail polish or something that's flammable. You could put little, you know, elements of explosives in 3-ounce bottles. And you can get those through the security checkpoints. But if it's 5 ounces of peanut butter or a 750-milliliter corked bottle of wine, they'll take it away from you. And so it's an incoherent system. And to pick on TSA as it tries to get real and rational about these rules over pocket knives, I think it's a cheap shot. I mean, this is the first time they've been reasonable since 9/11. Let's take it. And finally today, Mitch McConnell and his pals have gotten the FBI to look into the secret recording that Mother Jones released yesterday of a February 2nd campaign meeting of the group that wants to reelect Mitch McConnell in Kentucky. And I find this so amusing. By the way, I want to thank Edie in Atlanta for correcting me. I don't know that much about the Judds. Ashley is the actress, not a singer. And I appreciate her correction on that. At any rate, this is embarrassing to Mitch McConnell. But his campaign manager said that these are Nixonian Watergate-era tactics. And I punched up the Rusty Limbaugh show on my way to work this morning, and he picked up a call from a listener who pledged dittos to infinity, and then asked him about the illegal wiretapping of Mitch McConnell. Now, when I first heard a ditto head say he was opposed to illegal wiretapping, I said, wow, has Rush taken a position in support of the Fourth Amendment and against the surveillance program that's been continued by Obama? No. And there's no evidence that there was a microphone planted in the conference room or wherever this meeting was held. Mother Jones explicitly says they didn't bug the room. Somebody gave them a recording. And for $40, you can buy a little micro recorder. I've got two of them. Most smartphones allow you to record things now. And so it's much more likely that this was an inside leaker. And instead of pursuing that line of investigation, they're circling the wagons around Mitch McConnell, that he's been a victim of a Democratic plot to bring him down that includes illegal surveillance tactics. Oh, life is surreal today. I'm going to hop on Trigger here and just ride off into the warm California sunset. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.